This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Well, welcome everybody to our last session of today. And just a reminder that we are having an event tomorrow at 11 at the Arab American Museum in Dearborn, where the authors will give some further reflections on their subjects, and in some cases give an entirely different presentation. If you have friends in Dearborn, please tell them how great it would be if they came at 11 to the Arab American Museum. This afternoon, we're going to be addressed by Sherman Jackson, the King Faisal Chair in Islamic Thought and Culture and Professor of Religion and American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, who received his Ph.D. in Oriental Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and who is, of course, a longtime colleague here at the University of Michigan before he went to USC. An old friend, and we're so grateful to him for making time in his very busy schedule, directing a center there and so forth, to come out and address us on this subject. And he is going to talk about the Gamal al-Islamiyya, which the Islamic grouping, which emerged as a fundamentalist organization in the Sadat period and which went on to be implicated in terrorism in the 1990s, the leaders of which, while they were cooling their heels in Torah prison, gave some deep thought to how they had gotten where they were and what had gone wrong. And I'll let him tell us the rest of the story.
Thank you. Should I?
Yeah, go to the podium, okay. I think.
Well, first of all, you know, I can't see you guys because I need those glasses to see, but I can't read without these. So, it's really good to be back. 60 degrees is nothing between friends. But really, it's really good to be back and to see so many familiar faces, to sort of take in the familiar atmosphere. I appreciate this opportunity, Juan, to be called back to enjoy and partake of the intellectual capital in the room. I am an avowed technophobe, so I don't have any of that bid'ah to go up on the screen, et cetera. And I'm a bit worried about the time, so I'm just going to go into my paper and read it like a traditional, old-fashioned, straight-laced academic. Okay. I would like to begin my remarks this afternoon with a cautionary note of sorts. Today, whenever the concept of peace is invoked, it is usually against the perceived threat of physical martial violence. Peace, in other words, is routinely thought of as the absence or cessation of violence. This is especially the case when religion is brought into the discussion, and all the more so if the religion happens to be Islam. For those of us who are members of the academy, meanwhile, there is an additional challenge. Violence is the instrument of coercion par excellence. Coercion is the absolute enemy of philosophical liberalism. And philosophical liberalism dominates the Western academy, as it does the political and intellectual culture of America at large. Cumulatively, all of this results in an unspoken criterion that holds religion to be acceptable only to the extent that it can be domesticated and rendered incapable of challenging the state or the dominant culture, especially through the threat of violence. Those who are contemptuous or dismissive of religion are prone to invoking this criterion as an argument against religion, especially religions that appear to give any quarter to violence. Those who are sympathetic, meanwhile, often so eager to avoid any indictment or criticism of religion that they are incapable of critically engaging it in all its messiness as a lived reality. Both groups, however, run the risk of self-deception, as both are subject to seeing their respective contributions to the cause of peace as being much greater than they actually are. The celebrated Christian theologian Reinhold Niebuhr reminds us of just how treacherous the terrain of committing oneself to peace can actually be. In his book, Moral Man and Immoral Society, Niebuhr writes, and I quote, "So persistent is the cry of peace among the ruling classes, and so strong the seeming abhorrence of every form of violence and anarchy, that one might imagine them actuated by the purest pacifist principles, were it not for the fact that they betray no pacifist scruples when they consider international relations." Of course, in these our times of Eric Garner, Ferguson, Missouri, and the like, we need not restrict our gaze to the international arena. But Niebuhr would go on to observe an even more subtle liability lurking beneath the surface of many calls to peace. The tendency to equate peace with the simple absence of violence, he notes, often masks a false consciousness that fails to recognize just how devastating nonviolent injury can be to human life. The nonviolent abuse of economic, political, intellectual, or cultural power, or even the power differential, between a parent and a child, can be just as humanly damaging as bullets and bombs are physically destructive. In such a light, to target only those forms of injury towards which the West feels vulnerable, namely violence in the form of terrorism, while ignoring those forms of injury, including violence, to which others feel vulnerable, can hardly amount to a genuine or meaningful commitment to peace. Of course, wanton violence is a major impediment to peace, and given its magnitude and persistence in certain parts of the world, especially the Muslim world, it may be fitting for us scholars and students of Islam to prioritize violence as a problem. Still, I think we should be careful about surrendering to the false or self-serving criteria that render us party to an effective conspiracy to promote a kind of peace that serves the interests of some while blithely ignoring the legitimate right of others to a dignified existence. The fundamentalist perspective on Islam and peace, on which I shall focus this afternoon, is part of a contemporary Islamist group's self-critique of violence as the primary medium of exchange in negotiating political conflict over the public status and role of Islam. This singular focus on violence, however, should not be taken to imply that this group equates peace with the simple absence of violence, as if to say that once violence ceases to exist, everything will be fine. As we shall see, they are neither pacifists nor dead to the fact that society can be quite unhealthy even without violence. For them, however, the problem goes beyond the simple fact or occurrence of violence to the actual status of violence as an Islamic ideal. Their argument, in other words, is essentially against the tendency of Islamist movements to see violence as a duty that Islam imposes upon Muslims as a religious ideal. On such an understanding, of course, Islam could hardly be reconciled with the value of peaceful coexistence. This is part of the fallacy that these fundamentalist critics would like to challenge. Of course, fundamentalist is an ambiguous and much abused term. Let me state clearly that my use of the term does not imply any commitment to a literal approach to Muslim scripture or the intellectual tradition of Islam. Fundamentalism in a Muslim context refers rather to a particular mode of insisting on the public recognition of the authority of Islam, especially Sharia or Islamic law, as the organizing principle of Muslim society. While many Muslims who are not fundamentalists also share this commitment, what sets fundamentalists apart is their recognition of violence as a primary medium of exchange between them and those perceived to stand in the way of this goal. This valuation of violence, however, is grounded not so much in any literal reading of Muslim scripture as it is in a very particular valuation and deployment of Muslim history. As this history was one in which violence was recognized as both a given and an effective negotiating tool, the net result of taking it as the lens through which to read Muslim scripture and tradition is to convert violence into a transcendent value that appears to draw its legitimacy not from history or historical experience, but from Scripture itself. In other words, on this reading, violence becomes the Islamic language of social political negotiation, scripturally mandated, permanently normative, and universally applicable in all places and all times. In this context, the persuasiveness and allure of Muslim fundamentalism resides not so much in any literal authority it accords Muslim scripture, but in the uncritically inflated authority it accords a certain reading of pre-modern Muslim history, a reading that is effectively rendered invisible as a reading by the fact that it resonates so powerfully with a modern Muslim predicament, where, like their pre-modern forebears, Muslims see Islam as being under mortal attack. In other words, this reading produces an interpretive prism that is essentially composed of history, idealized, internalized, and then essentially forgotten as history. As peaceful coexistence was a part of the unimaginable in the pre-modern Muslim past, this perspective renders peaceful coexistence largely unimaginable for Muslim fundamentalists in the present. This filiation, however, is precisely what our group shall call into question. On October 6, 1981, the entire world was shocked by the brash spectacle of Egyptian President Anwar Sadat's assassination. This was part of a plan to take over the country and establish an Islamic state, the legal, social, economic, and political order of which would be explicitly defined and regulated by Sharia. This attempted coup had been orchestrated by an amalgamation of militant Islamist groups that came together the previous year under the banner of Egyptian Jihad Incorporated, Tanzim al-Jihad al-Misri, or more simply, Jihad Inc., Tanzim al-Jihad. Jihad Inc. was headed by Muhammad Abdusalam Faraj, and it included two other former groups, one led by Kamal Saeed Habib, the other a contingent largely from Upper Egypt, headed by Karim Zuhdi, under the name Al-Gama'a Al-Islamiyya. It is among the latter and some of its members that I shall focus primarily for the remainder of this presentation. Sadat's assassination was paralleled by an attempt by the Gama'a to take over the city of Esyut and from there march on to Cairo. The Cairo faction of Jihad Inc. succeeded in assassinating Sadat, as a result of which Faraj, Khalid al-Islambouli, and three others were executed. But the Gama'a's mission failed, as a result of which all of its leaders and scores of its members landed in prison. In prison, internal differences led to the dissolution of Jihad Inc., and the Gama'a al-Islamiyya resumed its status as an independent organization. This was also the beginning, however, of a new, more violent relationship with the Egyptian state and society. Between 1991 and 1995 alone, they killed an estimated 1,883 people, including Egyptian officials, Coptic Christians, Western tourists, secular intellectuals, security forces, and innocent bystanders. This was met, of course, by brutal government retaliations, including summary executions, mass incarceration, and torture. At one point, the number of incarcerated Gama'a members alone was placed between 15 and 30,000, making the Gama'a easily the largest radical jihadist movement in Egypt and the Arab world at the time. As both the Egyptian government and the Gama'a saw themselves engaged in an epic battle for their very existence, by the mid-90s, there was no end in sight to the vicious violence that raged between them. On July 5, 1997, however, the Gama'a stunned the nation. At his trial on charges of trying to blow up a bank, one of its members stood up in open court and read a statement signed by six first-tier Gama'a members, or leaders. Quote, "The historical leadership of Al-Gama'a al-Islamiyya calls upon their brethren from among the leadership and the rank and file to terminate without stipulation and with no prerequisites all armed campaigns and communiques that call for such, both inside and outside of Egypt, in the interest of Islam and the Muslims." End of quote. This was the beginning of the Gama'a's so-called initiative to stop the violence. A few years later, in 2002, they issued four manifestos under the series title Correcting Misunderstandings, Silsilat Tashih al-Mafahim. The explicit aim of these tracts was to repudiate the Gamal's old commitment to violence as their primary medium of exchange and to set the group upon a new ideological foundation. Importantly, the Gamal insisted that their new perspective was explicitly grounded in their new understanding of Sharia, which their years of incarceration had allowed them to study and actually learn, as opposed to simply imagining Sharia's provisions as they had done in the past. According to them, their study of Sharia brought them to appreciate the importance of properly assessing the situation on the ground as a prerequisite to a proper application of the religious law, what they came to refer to as fiqh al-waqi'a, the jurisprudence of factual reality. On this basis, they insisted that their approach to applying Sharia must recline upon two fundamental constituents. One, actual reality on the ground and its implications, and two, Sharia proofs from the Quran, Sunnah, or other recognized sources of the religious law. Only through a proper assessment of reality on the ground, in other words, could they determine whether a particular application of the law would actually serve its underlying goals and objectives, the so-called maqasid al-sharia. In the past, they admit, they paid absolutely no attention to any of this, but simply waged jihad based on what they took to be the plain dictates of scripture. Now, by contrast, they understand that a factual assessment of reality might be even more probative than the plain dictates of scripture in determining whether or not a rule should be applied. This new insight was at the heart of the misunderstanding that they now wanted to correct. What are these broader aims and objectives to which the Gamal repeatedly refers? Chief among them, they insist, is, quote, to guide humanity to God, to endear the people to their Lord and Creator, and to direct them to God through the least burdensome means and the easiest route. Violence, for its part, may be prescribed as a means of serving or protecting this mission, but only if the resulting benefits outweigh the harms. And here they insist that just because an injunction was carried out in a particular fashion in the past, even by pious ancestors or other heroes of the tradition, this does not mean that this rule must be applied in exactly the same fashion today, given the known differences between past and present reality. This, and not simply its status as a scripturally mandated institution of organized violence, is the litmus test to be applied whenever contemplating a decision to wage jihad. Otherwise, jihad can end up undermining the very aim it was instituted to serve, namely, guiding people to God and endearing them to their Lord and Creator. Of course, any connection between violence and guiding people to God would seem to be totally out of place in today's world. As we shall see, while they never abandoned the duty of jihad in principle, the Gamal does appear to be willing to look this modern reality straight in the face. This is actually the basis upon which they take their critique beyond Egypt to contemporary jihadism in general, and to Al-Qaeda in particular. In 2004, its leadership published a jointly authored book entitled Al-Qaeda, Strategy and Bombings. Al-Qaeda Strategy and Bombings, Mistakes and Dangers, Estrategia wa Tafjirat Al-Qaeda, Al-Akhta wal-Akhtar. They are careful to insist that they mean no disrespect to Sheikh Osama bin Laden, nor to impugn Al-Qaeda's intentions or downplay America's negative role in the region. They merely want to point out Al-Qaeda's fundamental misunderstanding of Sharia, including their failure to effect a proper assessment of reality on the ground. Specifically, according to them, Al-Qaeda tends to proceed on a pre-modern division of the world into believers and unbelievers, and then allows this division to do all of their thinking for them. Whereas such a division may have implied lethal hostility between Muslims and non-Muslims in the past, in the modern world, such a relationship must be assessed or determined and not merely assumed. Whereas Al-Qaeda assumes that U.S. and Muslim interests are completely and permanently contradictory based on the legacy of Muslim-non-Muslim relations in the pre-modern past, the Gamal holds up concrete contemporary examples that challenge this assumption, such as America's support for the Afghan Mujahideen. Similarly, while Al-Qaeda holds any kind of truce, negotiation, or alliance with America to be tantamount to Islamic treason, the Gemara points out that such a position contradicts well-known practices of the Prophet Muhammad himself, who made treaties and alliances with the same pagan Arabians who opposed, vilified, and attacked him and his religion. Of course, none of this should be misunderstood. The Gemara explicitly points to America's abject bias regarding the Arab-Israeli conflict, its hypocritical, self-serving promotion of democracy, human rights, and the protection of women and religious minorities, not to mention U.S. economic exploits in the region. All of this, the Gemara roundly condemns, even as they recognize the Muslim Ummah's obligation to confront these challenges, including perhaps by way of jihad. The question, however, both from the standpoint of a proper understanding of geopolitical reality and from the perspective of Sharia, is whether the kind of wanton violence and bellicosity advocated by Al-Qaeda is the appropriate or most effective response. For if the overall aim of Al-Qaeda's jihadism, indeed of any jihadism, is, as it must be from the perspective of the religious law, to promote the broader aims and objectives of Islam, such as guiding the people to God, not only has this violence not served this interest, it has gone so far as to, and I quote, turn the entire world not only against Al-Qaeda, but against Islam as a whole. By contrast, while again not ruling out jihad altogether, the Gemara seems to anticipate the view more recently expressed by Sheikh Yusuf Al-Qaradawi. In the age of Twitter, satellite TV, and the internet, Al-Qaradawi noted that violence, including Western imperial violence, may no longer be the greatest threat to Islam. And to the extent that violence is not the primary threat, it is not likely to be an effective response. Thus, rather than more violent jihadis, what Islam needs today is, and I quote, a massive army of preachers, teachers, journalists, and those who are competent in training people in how to address today's public and the language of the age and the style of the times through voice, image, spoken word, physical gesture, books, pamphlets, magazines, newspapers, dialogue, documentaries, drama, and motion pictures, end of quote. At the time the Gemara issued these manifestos, the overwhelming majority of its leadership was still in prison. We can talk about that in the question and answer period. Once out of prison, support between 2003 and 2005, however, most of them had been released. Once out of prison, support for the initiative to stop the violence proceeded apace, and certain members continued to churn out tracts that expanded on its basic theme. This was especially the case with Najih Ibrahim, a stalwart first-tier leader who went back to the very beginning and whose signature appeared on all of the corrective manifestos. Following his release, Ibrahim began to develop a progressively more independent voice that may have been more representative of his own ideas than it was of the Gemara's platform overall. Indeed, explicit signs of tension between him and at least a faction within the group appear in 2015, or maybe it was 2014, I don't exactly recall, when the Gemara's official website announced a temporary pause in its operations and that those who wished to continue following Ibrahim's views could do so on a separate website. Up to that point, not only had Ibrahim administered the Gemara's website, his views had virtually taken it over. Now, however, the cumulative effects of the Arab Spring, the ascension of Morsi, the Kuvolution and subsequent crackdown by Sisi, along with the ominous rise of ISIS, were sowing disagreement within the movement. Ibrahim, along with Karam Zuhdi, who had now been replaced as leader of the Gemara by another stalwart from back in the day, who recently died in Sisi's prison, were pitted against a more restless faction, who, while sticking to the initiative to stop the violence, at least for the moment, felt that the group should be doing more to address the political situation in Egypt and to raising Islam to its rightful place as the ultimate social-political arbiter. This is the backdrop against which, in 2014, Ibrahim teamed up with a former rank-and-file member of the Gemara, Hisham al-Najjar, who had resigned in protest over certain differences with the restless faction. Together, they wrote a book against ISIS entitled ISIS, The Knife That Slaughters Islam, Daesh, that's the word for ISIS in Arabic, السكين التي تطبع الإسلام. While their critique is pointed most directly at ISIS, it also includes a parallel criticism of Islamist movements in general. Based on what I detect of Ibrahim's writing style during his tenure as administrator of the Gamal's website, about two-thirds of this book appear to be written by him, with the last third being the contribution of An-Najjar. At the most basic level, ISIS's most fatal flaw, according to Ibrahim An-Najjar, is its inability to distinguish between its interests as a movement and the interests of the Muslim Ummah as a whole. On this confusion, it sees itself as the exclusive representative of Islam, who will bring victory, majesty, and dignity back to the religion and restore Muslims to their proper place in the world. Of course, only those who do not welcome such an agenda could stand in ISIS's way. As such, anyone who opposes or even fails to support ISIS is an enemy of Islam. In the West, or perhaps I should say perhaps among Muslims in the West, the tendency is to see all of this in terms of how it contributes to ISIS's rush to excommunication or takfir, and the wanton intolerance and violence that goes along with this. But for Ibrahim and An-Najjar, the problem is much broader. While ISIS's violence and viciousness are problems, to be sure, its navel-gazing, short-sighted perspective overall is even of greater concern. For this condemns the group to a small-mindedness that preempts its ability to understand the true nature of the challenges facing it or the Ummah, not to mention how to avail itself of opportunities in the modern world that can actually serve the Ummah's long-term interests. In short, according to Ibrahim and An-Najjar, while ISIS may speak of an Islamic state or a caliphate, it is actually unable to think, let alone act, like a state or a caliphate. Instead, ISIS behaves like a gang, a militia, or a fraternity whose addiction to violence and bellicosity denies it the ability to understand, let alone achieve, what it takes to thrive geopolitically in the modern world. This is clearly manifested, according to Ibrahim and An-Najjar, in ISIS's contemptuous behavior toward world powers and their leaders. They cite, for example, a letter ISIS reportedly sent to Turkey's Erdogan following his ascent to power, in which they state, quote, "Oh, Mr. Secularist, we will soon occupy your country and turn you out of it," end of quote. They make similar threats against Russia's Putin and to then British Prime Minister David Cameron. To this, they add such heinous acts as beheading American journalists and executing diplomats sent from the Syrian Islamist group Jabhat al-Nusra. They go on to excommunicate Muslim groups as diverse as the Nahda Party in Tunis and a long list of groups in Egypt, including the Freedom and Justice Party, founded by members of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Light Party, An-Nur, founded by Salafists, and the Building and Development Party, Al-Binat wa Tanmiyah, founded by members of the Gamal itself. Of course, all Shiites are infidels on a fortiori grounds. Again, while these actions are all problematic in and of themselves, Ibrahim and An-Najjar says that what is even more disturbing is the gross immaturity and naivete they reflect about what it means to operate as a nation, especially in the interest of a global community such as the Muslim Ummah. For no state, not even a superpower, let alone a caliphate, could exist or function effectively without allies. Yet ISIS recognizes neither the concept nor possibility of friend or ally, except with regard to those who unconditionally accept their party line. Indeed, according to Ibrahim and An-Najjar, ISIS raises the enterprise of creating enemies to the level of a science, earning them what they refer to as a PhD in creating enemies. Ustadhiya fi san' al-a'da. Yet, asks Ibrahim and An-Najjar, what kind, and by the way, these are Gamal members saying this. Yet, asks Ibrahim and An-Najjar, what kind of reasonable state or even reasonable movement would act like this? Quote, "What kind of caliph is this whose state couldn't even fix the tracks on a tank, service the wheels on a fighter jet, or fix a broken radar, yet will make all kinds of threats and promises to the whole world in language that is nothing but arrogance, bluster, pettiness, and vulgarity, such as their letter that they address to Obama, the dog of Byzantium, Kelberum." The reference to President Obama as the dog of Byzantium points precisely to ISIS's myopic relationship with Muslim history. The phrase Kalb al-Rum comes from a letter reportedly sent by the Abbasid Caliph Harun al-Rashid over 1,000 years ago to the Byzantine ruler Nicephorus at Naqfur in response to the latter's refusal to pay up a tribute that had been agreed upon by his predecessor, the Empress Irene. The Caliph invades Byzantium, defeats the Byzantines, and extracts an even higher tribute. Now, Ibrahim and Najjar ask, what has Obama and America to do with the Byzantines? The answer, of course, is nothing. Obama is black, and the Americans are a mixture of races and religions. But such phrases as Kalb al-Rum are part of an escapist narrative used by preachers and religious teachers to tickle the emotions of the Muslim masses by reminding them of their powerful and glorious past, without mentioning that this power and glory did not come out of nowhere, but was the result of assiduous dedication in all aspects of human civilization. Again, this misguided approach is not unique to ISIS. It is typical of modern Islamist movements as a whole, who, and I quote here, repeat the same old rhetoric and the same old stories time and again, despite the radically different historical circumstances out of which these stories emerge. Rather than devote themselves, in other words, to acquiring and or deploying the kinds of skills and resources that would actually enable them to compete on the world stage, these movements jeopardize the lives and interests of Muslims by rendering them prisoners and ultimately victims of this misleading narrative. Again, this is a prime example of how history, as opposed to Islamic scripture, becomes the source of the tendency to raise violence to a transcendent first-order value. This is an extremely serious problem, according to Ibrahim and Najjar, as it threatens not only to distort Islam as a blueprint for a healthy individual and collective life, but to undermine the very authority of scripture itself. As they put it, and I quote, turning certain chapters of Muslim history into proofs that can be invoked in a manner that rivals the authority of religion and the religious law itself is among the major contemporary crises, especially when the protagonists of these stories from the past are kings and secular rulers. Trying to follow in the tracks of an ancient history in times and places that bear no relation, resemblance, or likeness to that history will continue to bring catastrophe upon the Islamist movement. End of quote. Of course, Ibrahim and Najjar are clear that this is a very selective reading of Muslim history, one that is crafted with the aim of legitimizing a certain approach to social political conflict in the name of Islam. Otherwise, they point out, one would not be so easily able to cast aside well-known and even more authoritative alternatives to such a reading. For example, in the case of addressing President Obama or other political leaders, they point to the precedent set by the Prophet Muhammad himself, who in addressing the non-Muslim rulers of Egypt and Byzantium deliberately used the Arabic honorific phrase, Azim, the Great, which was clearly intended to convey respect. To Heracles, the Great of Byzantium, to Macacus, the Great of Egypt. Again, this crassly pragmatic invocation of Muslim history contributes much and directly to ISIS's inflated estimation of violence, as they imagine it to have catapulted their Muslim ancestors to victory in the glorious past. It does not take much, however, to see that this perspective is reinforced, if not partly inspired, by what is seen to be the obvious role that violence played in the West's colonial and post-colonial success. In other words, this is simply part of the common tendency of the vanquished to imitate the victor. At any rate, according to Ibrahim and Najjar, the single-minded focus on violence comes at the expense of the civilizational dimensions of Islam. And it is only according to them, as a civilization, a Habara Islamia, whose groundedness in religion gives it the bearing and confidence to contribute to and benefit from cultural, intellectual, and commercial exchange with other cultures and civilizations, that Islam can compete on the global stage and provide for its own long-term sustainability. This is the way it was, it actually was in the Muslim past, going all the way back to the time of the Prophet himself. But again, the narrative generated by ISIS does not recognize the value of culture or civilization. And this is why, according to Ibrahim and Najjar, the skills and talents displayed by some of its most gifted recruits are almost never deployed beyond the goal of exercising control over its populace or waging war against the West. In this way, ISIS shoots both itself and the Ummah in the foot. For, and I quote, even if they are able to seize control over this or that patch of land, nations and civilizations are not just patches of geography or caches of weapons. They are something much broader, much more inclusive, and deeper. Nations are extensions of culture, civilization, history, and inherited values, as well as social and religious heterodyning. End of quote. This combination, according to Ibrahim and Najjar, is what enables nations to sustain themselves, influence others, and thrive in the face of the kinds of challenges that typically face nations. But ISIS's obliviousness to the value of culture and civilization and its assumption that power and violence can substitute for these impedes its ability to properly conceptualize, let alone build what Ibrahim and Najjar refer to as a modern state, a Dawla Asriya, not to mention a superstate in the form of a caliphate. Here, the author's assessment is couched in a rather sanitized depiction of Europe and America, who are imagined to have completely overcome such challenges as dictatorship, injustice, inequality, lack of freedom, and the treatment of minorities. At the same time, it proceeds on the assumption that the solutions arrived at by the West are exactly those anticipated by the broader aims and objectives of Sharia. By contrast, according to them, ISIS's obliviousness to a proper understanding of Sharia condemns them to ignoring the structural imperatives of Islam, such as serving the common weal, equality before the law, freedom, administrative accountability, and respect for minorities, sacrificing all of this in favor of an almost exclusive focus on the so-called prescribed punishments, or hudud, as some sort of symbolic representation of a normative Islamic order. This is based, according to Ibrahim and Najjar, on both an abuse and a misunderstanding of political power in Islam. For political power, a sulta, is not the private property of the Muslim ruler or caliph to be used solely to solidify and enhance his position. On the contrary, it is a public trust, an amana, that is to be used to promote the public interest. But ISIS has no time for such structural imperatives as constitutional values, al-qiyam al-dusturiyya. As a result, their program remains very simple, autocracy in the name of religion. Al-istibdad bismiddin. Of course, there is much in pre-modern Muslim history, like the history of the rest of the pre-modern world, that can be called upon to lend support to non-representative government. And this is why the unhealthy relationship that Muslim fundamentalists have with their history is so problematic. For not only does this reading apotheosize this history, thus retarding Muslim efforts to oppose autocracy in the name of Islam, it weakens Muslims' ability to resist the power and confidence wielded by those who enjoy the fruits of representative government. In effect, it renders the socio-political grass outside of Islam seductively greener than anything that Muslims can boast. Thus, write Ibrahim and Najjar, this is a quote from them, Barack Obama, sitting in his office in the White House in Washington, with his shiny black shoes and long legs stretched out over his desk, will be able to dismantle this so-called caliphate with the greatest of ease, not with Scud missiles and drones, but with the power that the high constitutional principles and values of Sharia confer upon any people, even if they are not Muslims. End of quote. Again, while ISIS is the direct object of this critique, it is aimed at Islamist movements in general. For almost all of them, in the view of Ibrahim and Najjar, are blinded by their inflated estimation of violence and coercive power to the necessity of ingratiating their constituencies with the values, virtues, and possibilities of their religion, en route to establishing a mutually supportive relationship between Islam and the people, Muslim and non-Muslim alike. This, they warn, will ultimately result in a population of hypocrites who thrive on dishonesty, duplicity, and facile opportunism as survival mechanisms, whose intentions are never pure but always provisional, and who come to love, hate, fear, and cower to power and anyone associated with it. Here, incidentally, in their own move to draw on the authority of pre-modern Muslim history, Ibrahim and Najjar invoke the celebrated father of sociology, Ibn Khaldun. They quote, "When political power is used in a manner that is overly domineering, abusive, and quick to punish, constantly seeking to expose people's breaches and enumerate their sins, fear and humiliation invariably grip the people, and they in turn seek refuge in lying and deception, and their inner consciences are thoroughly compromised. In sum, the kind of religious autocracy embraced and promulgated by ISIS and other Islamist groups will unavoidably result not only in dysfunctional states and a stillborn caliphate, but also in a society of scarred and broken people. Feeble replicas of Adorno's authoritarian personality, this will be a mass of bullies who are also easily bullied, men and women who are subservient not only to rightful guides and superiors, but to anyone who is more powerful than they are. And all of this, alas, perpetuated and legitimized in the name of Islam." There's one final aspect of Ibrahim and Najjar's critique that I would like to mention briefly. As is known, ISIS espoused a certain apocalyptic vision connected with the Syrian town of Dabiq, after which it named its magazine. Ibrahim and Najjar do not refer to Dabiq directly, but take up the general issue of apocalyptic statements attributed to the Prophet, as they see these as another way in which ISIS seeks not only to confer religious legitimacy upon the primacy of violence, but to imbue ordinary Muslims and potential recruits with a sense of being religiously bound to support such commitments to bloodletting. Ibrahim's and Najjar's response is that, leaving aside the question of whether these reports from the Prophet are all reliable, there is a difference between what they refer to as a khitab shar'i, or a divine injunction, and a khitab qadari, or a divine report. While a divine injunction requires Muslims to act in a manner that fulfills that injunction, a divine report requires only that Muslims believe in such reports. Thus, for example, if the Prophet reports that the caliphate will be dismantled into petty kingdoms, this does not require Muslims to contribute to this dismantling. It merely requires of them that they believe that this will ultimately happen. In terms of their actual actions, divine injunctions may actually require Muslims to act in a manner that forestalls or reverses an inevitable occurrence. The same logic applies to end of time reports regarding apocalyptic confrontations between Muslims and non-Muslims. It does not dictate that the relationship between the two can only be one of violence. All of this takes us back to a concern expressed by the Gemara as a whole back in 2002 and the beginning of its initiative to stop the violence. There they expressed deep anxieties about how the acceptance of violence as the most Islamically authentic means for Muslims to deal with social political conflict can become entrenched to the point that it is raised beyond critique. Then they wrote the following: "We fear that if matters persist as they are and the flames of vengeance continue to smolder in people's hearts, that the matter will get out of hand, the tear in the fabric will expand beyond any mender's ability, and it will no longer fall within the capacity of anyone to return matters to their proper course. Similarly, we fear that the continuation of these confrontations will generate new misunderstandings that become normalized with the passing of time, to the point that those who hold such understandings, due to their long familiarity with them, come to believe that they are factually consistent with Sharia, and that there is nothing wrong with them. In fact, subsequent generations will come to receive these notions as if they were the very core and the spirit of religion." There are other, in my view, less salient features of Ibrahim's and Najjar's critique that time will not permit me to cover here. For example, more could be said about the role of sectarianism in ISIS's approach and the charge that ISIS is a godsend to Western powers who want to keep the Muslim world weak and divided. This actually goes back, this particular critique, to an aspect of the Gemara's own self-critique back in the 1990s and the early 2000s. At that time, They chided themselves over the fact that their fundamentalist activities kept the Egyptian state, the largest Arab Muslim regional power, turned in on its own internal problems, leaving Israel and the United States free to romp about as they pleased. Beyond this, there are a number of points on which one might want to challenge Ibrahim and the Najat, such as the sense they give that everything that led to the West ascendancy was already there in Islam centuries earlier, just waiting to be activated, or the impression that they occasionally give that Muslim scripture totally devalues violence. Then there is the question of how exactly, in concrete terms, to impose principled restrictions on the enterprise of calibrating scriptural interpretations to changes in history. In conclusion, however, again, given the limits of time, there are two final observations that I would like to register. I only have two pages, can I? Because otherwise I'm going to speed
up. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Because I get nervous and I start talking real fast.
All right. Sorry.
The first is simply a reminder that for all the pragmatism displayed in the analyses of Ibrahim and An-Najjar, indeed by the Gemara as a whole, their critique is fundamentally, this is an important point, based in a reading of Sharia. In this regard, it does not differ in kind, even if it may in degree and detail, from critiques put forth by members of the official religious establishment. Perhaps the biggest difference is that the Gemara members tend to take a more macro approach as opposed to the more detail-oriented, casuistic, or micro approach reflected, for example, in the fatwa of Sheikh Muhammad Yaqubi or the joint letter sent to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi by a group of Muslim scholars and clerics from around the world. Nevertheless, the Gemara's critique should give pause to those who tend to look upon Sharia, or what has become known in the West as Sharia law, as invariably contributing to the mentality of ISIS or other extremists, and never fundamentally challenging any of this. Our authors demonstrate, in other words, that not only can principled critiques of ISIS come from liberals, secularists, or so-called progressives, they can also come from the pens of bearded men with fundamentalist ties and strong attachments to Sharia. The second observation relates to the moral status of violence in the critique of Ibrahim and An-Najjar. While our authors are explicit in condemning violence on practical grounds, there seems to be little in the way of moral condemnation, that is, violence as a moral evil that stands in the way of peace as a moral good. This is more a matter, however, of my own particular reading of them. At several points and under several headings, they strongly and explicitly condemn ISIS's violence on moral grounds. In fact, they insist that ISIS's violence not only violates Islam, but the very norms of manhood, ar-rujula, and a normative Arab sense of self, al-uruba. Indeed, they insist such violence bespeaks, and I quote here, a rupture of the basic constitution of human mercy that should reside in the heart of any human being, let alone any Muslim, be he or she Sunni or Shiite, end of quote. But I have chosen not to place this moral critique front and center in an effort to avoid the risk of distorting the overall thrust of their message by allowing it to be overly informed by our Western obsession, especially in the post-9/11 Western obsession, with Muslim violence and barbarity. In the West, we tend to focus on little more than ISIS's violence and intolerance. And in the Muslim community, this is routinely more for the purpose of distancing American Muslims from such behavior than it is out of any recognition of any broader aims and objectives of Islam that might be obliterated thereby. From this vantage point, it becomes easy for us to recognize critiques of ISIS's violence, but more difficult to see anything beyond this. By contrast, Ibrahim and An-Najjar seem to be saying that while violence is a problem, to be sure, there is much more to be considered beyond the question of violence. In fact, their message seems to be that were ISIS to adopt or acquire a more comprehensive understanding of Sharia, according to which ample attention and priority went to such enterprises as culture, civilization, economics, and the development of political thought, the very value of their brand of violence would be drastically reduced even in their own eyes, as it would be seen as being totally irrelevant to Islam's long-term interests and the restoration of its place in the world. It may be, then, that by our focusing so supremely and exclusively on ISIS's and other Muslim extremist groups' violence, we may be actually closer to them and our thinking than we care to recognize. For in maintaining such a focus, we seem to be essentially saying that we see little wrong with ISIS other than their addiction to wanton physical cruelty. Clearly, however, going back to the opening cautionary note with which I began, this can easily set us up to become, in our own context, purveyors of a kind of peace that, while devoid of violence, reflects just how thoroughly the powers that be have beguiled and indeed conquered us right in the very depths of our souls. Thank you very much.
I'd like to get these glasses. Yes, you're welcome to get the other glasses now. So,
should I sit down or?
I think, why don't you do what you feel comfortable okay. doing? I think we're going to, our schedule says that I would make some remarks now, but this is such a rich paper and so timely. I think I'd rather cede my time to the audience discussion. I'm sure you're very eager to interact with Professor Jackson. So do you mind just taking your own questions? Yeah.
Like coming back home.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm sorry to point. I
Yeah, wait for for the mic.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much for that, as Juan just said, a very rich paper. I think it's such a nice reminder, too, that, I mean, you know, in the Christian world, as in the Muslim world, fundamentalism began with this kind of energetic, engaged, loving kind of engagement with texts, which were perceived to have to be created at a temporal distance from the present, but still to speak to the present, right, in a very meaningful way. And so I love the way your paper began with that kind of engagement. And I loved the transformation of the Gamma indeed by studying these texts while in isolation. Excuse me. But my question for you is this. When you were describing Ibrahim and Najjar's critique of ISIS, it sounded very much like you were talking about liberal critiques of Trump and Trump's regime. Was that at all intentional? I mean, I was seeing kind of a mirror of the world that we're living in today. Was that at all intentional and a deliberate part of your argument? Or would you care to comment on it?
Well, deliberate only in the sense that I'm trying to be sort of true to my understanding of what Ibrahim and Najjar are themselves trying to convey. I would not have too much of a problem with describing this as a sort of liberal critique, with one exception. And I don't want to get into this. Naeem, we can fight about this. But I think that, and this is one of my critiques, quite frankly, of the Western Academy. I think that liberal values, I mean, such as freedom, all right, freedom of speech and these kinds of things are one thing. Liberal procedures for producing and sustaining them are something else. And we tend to equate one with the other. So the liberal value of, you know, freedom of minorities, for example, all right, I mean, you can do that through a Rawlsian liberalism, or you can do it by simply saying, look, Sharia says Christians can drink wine, end of discussion. So they have that freedom without the Rawlsian public reason kind of criterion. And I think the tendency is often to conflate these two. So if we mean by liberal values, I mean, you know, freedom and, you know, accountability and things like that, then yes, all right? But their point of departure would be Sharia and that whole Sharia tradition, not Rawlsian liberalism, if that makes sense. To me, we constantly, you know, superimpose this on our analyses of Islam, and this to me is very problematic. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you, Professor Jackson.
Wait! Remember, I can retroactively.
I know. Okay. He's my old advisor. Not old. Okay.
So I can retroactively.
thank you for that presentation. It was very interesting. And so one question I have is, and I think you might have touched. You did touch on this. But would you think it's fair to say that with Al Jama'a Al Islamiyya, they're in critiquing Daesh, ISIS, their focus is more on maslaha or the common good. You mentioned the moral dimension. But it seems that more of their focus is on maslaha, or the common good, whereas the open letter to al-Baghdadi and Muhammad al-Yaqubi's work seems to be focused more on like where they violated Sharia principles. There is some maslaha there, but it seems like their focus is what, you know, the laws of Sharia that were violated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Would you think, that's a fair assessment? And then why do you think there's that difference?
Well, I would I'm going to be careful because all this is being recorded again. I would say that the letter to Baghdadi goes beyond simply the micro detailed sort of violations of specific provisions of Sharia. It was also a call to reinstate the ulama, all right, to sort of a proper place of authority within Muslim community, whereby they become the go-to, I mean, for all issues Islamic. The Gamaa doesn't quite agree with that, all right? And they have, in a sense, their own relationship with the Sharia tradition that is separate and distinct from that of the religious establishment, all right? And their maslahi approach is much, in a sense, more explicit and elastic, and this is one of the problems with it, than the more sort of disciplined approach to that we find among the religious establishment. So I see some distinctions between their two approaches. But now, of course, as you know, the Gamaa may differ with the establishment on this or that detail, but agree with them on the general issue of condemning ISIS. And they might come together and, you know, issue something jointly or whatever. I don't know. But between that letter and the Gamaa's approach, I see that distinction. All right? Now, in their manifesto, they sound like fuqaha. But they don't have the constraints of the fuqaha. What do I mean by that? I think we don't often recognize that just like lawyers here, there's a legal culture. All right? And the fuqaha are sort of bound by that legal culture. I remember here in Michigan, back in 1999, 2000, I think it was, we had a conference here. It was an organization that I was heading at the time, Sharia Scholars Association of North America. And we had a big conference here in Detroit. And a number of bigwigs came from the Muslim world, including Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi. He was allowed in the country at that time. And there was a controversial issue that came up about home mortgages and things like that. And I remember Sheikh Yusuf saying it really impressed me. He said, okay, listen, you know, I have a controversial opinion here, all right? I have an opinion that a lot of people are not going to like, okay? But I'm going to express it anyway, because I've seen too many of my colleagues die with opinions still stuck in their breasts, okay? In other words, the legal culture, all right, would not allow for the expression of certain views, all right? The Gamaa is freer from that, so they can express those views more freely. It's not that the views themselves are a novel or alien. They just can express them with more explicitness and more freedom because they're not bound by the same legal culture that many of the fuqaha are.
Quick follow-up. Would you say then that what separates them then from ISIS is how they read not so much scripture but geopolitical reality?
Yeah, but I think that they have a different understanding. I think this whole business of history is critical. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And devising methodologies that are capacious enough, you know, to deal with this evolutionary energy, all right, without sort of degenerating into, you know, crass relativism, that's one of the challenges of Muslim Shari'i thinking in the modern world, right? To me, I think that the Gamaa goes part of the way, but there's still some issues that would need to be rectified with their particular approach. But to me, what's really interesting and in a sense important about the Gamaa, and this is the aspect that I think that has gone, you know, completely unrecognized. When they first came out with the initiative to stop the violence, Ayman al-Zawahiri was in Afghanistan at the time, and he sent telegraph. He sent a message to the Gamaa leaders. And the message was, ittaqullah. In other words, like, fear God, shame on you. All right? You guys are capitulating. The Gamaa's answer? Brother, please. No,
I
mean.
They didn't say brother.
Ayman, you are going to preach to us? You, who are tortured and turn state's evidence, gonna preach to us who spent 25, 6 years in prison? Mum's the word? We don't think so. So the street credibility that they have, all right, is extremely important. Recently, I talked to the son of a very prominent Muslim Brotherhood leader who's now in prison under Sisi's regime. His son was actually shot at Rabah, all right, and was also in prison. So I asked him, so how's the Jamaat Islamiyah doing? And he said to me, they are the most sophisticated on the scene right now. Mm-hmm. All right? And in the early period of the Morsi debacle, they said, okay, Muslim Brotherhood, you guys now have lost the presidency. Be careful that you don't lose the people. I mean, this is the kind of sort of pragmatic manner of proceeding that they have, still very intimately tied to a Shari'i tradition. But their street credibility, I think, is really important.
Thank you for an amazing talk. I have a million questions, and I'm only going to ask two because I want to try to make it to the campus, Jumu'ah, in a few minutes. The first is a rephrase of Carla's question that takes the liberalism out of it and asks about a kind of Trump reading with the idea that we are being recorded. just to rephrase it, using your own words, a society of bullies that are easily bullied. I guess I'd just like you to comment on the parallels in that. Carla, is that a useful rephrase of part of your question? Okay, and it's related to the question that I wanted to ask independently, which was about hypocrisy. Sheikh Tijani Cisse, the great Senegalese scholar, says that when, in commenting on La Ikraha Fid Din, when you force conversion upon someone, you don't gain a believer, you gain a hypocrite. And Ibn Khaldun's own words were a kind of historical critique of the problem that poses within Muslim civilization. So I guess I'd just like you to expand on those two points, a society of bullies that are also easily bullied, and the problem of hypocrisy, as you see it, as much perhaps as Ibrahim and Najjar see it, in contemporary Islamist discourse.
You know, it's
you know, it's, and I swear it's not a trap.
No. But it's amazing. I mean, just existentially sort of reflecting here, how on the one hand, how we are so very proud of lauding the degree of freedom that we control, and yet in certain circumstances we feel just as constrained, you know, as anybody in any third world country almost. And I think that's something for us to really seriously contemplate. Your question is a huge one, but I think that I would, in a sense, my interest would be in, you know, how this would apply, not to sort of Islamist movements worldwide. To be quite frank, I'm not as interested in them as I'm not as interested in them as I am in how this plays out in an American context. I mean, that's sort of my real forum. Although I don't see
it that way, then please.
Yeah. I mean, when we look at I see a lot of crass pragmatism in the manner in which Muslims are going about trying to deal with their issues. I've made certain statements for example about how I don't think that the American Constitution is in violation of in the broad sense. Don't get me wrong. In the broad sense, violation of Sharia. They're two different things. All right, and you know, you get criticism. Okay. President Trump comes out and issues a Muslim ban. What's the first thing somebody saying Muslims say? It's unconstitutional.
Both sides of their mouth.
I mean, and not being in a position to understand, I do think that there's something related to the manner in which, you know, the sort of culture that autocracy sort of produces, mm-hmm. All right? That there's a hypocrisy that functions as a survival mechanism, and it's so entrenched that we can't see it. All right? I don't want to go any farther than that, but I do see manifestations of that. And I think that it's one of our responsibilities, I mean, in as humane and brotherly or sisterly a manner as we can, you know, to point this out. This is a very, very unhealthy a phenomenon. And I think that what Muslims have to understand, non-Muslims can see it. So like Nietzsche said, you know, my genius is in my nostrils. I can smell it a mile away. And they can. And I think this is extremely problematic. Muslims have to state who they are, what they stand for, and be willing to pay the price for what that means. Hypocrisy will not do them any good. And I do see manifestations of a sort of crass pragmatism. Professor Sani is he's dying to say something.
Yeah, I just wonder if I may follow up. One of the things I learned from your wonderful presentation in the critique of ISIL and extremism from the point of view of the Muslim world is that ISIL and other radical groups seem to be a tragic diversion from the potential of Islam and the Muslim world to offer something to the world that the world really needs. I reflect on that a little bit perhaps more than I do on the application of this to America, because I am in touch with various parts of the Muslim world, and I know the enormous goodwill and potential there is, and the preoccupation with violence, with security issues about Islam, I see as a tragic
sucking the oxygen out of the air
distraction from what is really the case. I don't know, I caught some of this in your presentation.
Yeah, I mean, the Gemara themselves and their earlier self-critique, they are very, very explicit about that. We were part of the problem, they are saying, all right? We kept our state and our society preoccupied with all these issues of violence and security, et cetera, to the point that it had no or diminished energies, I mean, to devote to other things. And we ourselves, all right, were not aware of the civilizational dimensions of Islam and what it can contribute to the world, that we were so preoccupied sort of with violence. So that is a part of their outlook. Let me just say one thing about this whole business of when Professor Ware was asking me the question, I said, you know, my primary focus is on America. I'm not talking about any kind of American exceptionalism. I don't mean I have no connections with the Muslim world, but I think one of the things that I see, and let me just speak frankly here, all right? As a black American convert to Islam, I see what is going on now in the context of a history in which Islam enjoyed a certain prestige, legitimacy, indigeneity in the black community in America that it has progressively lost over the past two decades. And I see that as a tragedy, both for Islam and America. And so for me, restoring that as part of what you were talking about yesterday, in a way that positions Muslims to be looked at as valued interlocutors in the American project. If that the indigeneity, my own word. If that indigeneity is lost, all right, which is constantly being lost, to the point that Muslim now doubles for immigrant. I mean, that makes others work, that does their work for them. They don't have to do anything else. So USA, USA, USA sounds like what? No Muslim, no Muslims, no Muslims. This is tragic. So addressing that issue is one of my major concerns. I'm not saying I have no interest in what goes on in the Muslim world, or in the relationship between the Muslim world and the West. But just as a priority, you know, we talk about the Ummah a lot, and somehow America or American Muslims as part of the Ummah does not quite make it into that construct. That's one of my concerns.
So perhaps we could just take one more and then we'll have to close.
Yes, an easy one.
All right. So at the risk of being a walking stereotype, I'm a white kid studying security issues. And I don't think we hear critiques like these enough. This is something very new to me and very unique, actually. I'm not familiar with anything else like this. And in my studies, I have not heard of anything like this. Is there other stuff like this out there?
There's a book that was published a couple of years ago. It's called Sadat's Assassins and the Renunciation of Political Violence. It was written by this guy. I think his name is Jackson, I think is his name. So there's a whole book out there on this. It's on the Gamay Islamiyah and this very enterprise. I'm considering, they produce 4 manifestos. I'm considering applying for a grant to do the others and do a whole bunch of them. I don't know about now, CCC Egypt is a little, but I, you know, this is why I did it, to be quite frank, okay? And I started this when I was here at Michigan, and we were reading some of this stuff in some of my graduate seminars, and my students were like, I mean, they couldn't believe it. And they said, why is this not more accessible to the general American readership? So I felt that, and this would also contribute to that whole American discourse as well. But I don't know. I mean, why is there not more work on this kind of thing? And by the way, they have influenced de-radicalization movements in Saudi Arabia, in Libya, in Egypt itself. And this has been going on since 1997. I don't know where this is going, however. The situation in Egypt is very, very touchy. As I said, one of their leaders was re-imprisoned and he died in prison. So far as I understand, the Gamay is holding on to this initiative to stop the violence. But I think that, and this may be one of the, I mean, I don't do the political science thing, but I'm speaking aloud in terms of what I do know. I worry about what the present administration may contribute to autocratic leaders in the Muslim world, sense that they can jail, torture, etc., with impunity, because these jails are factories for jihadis. They are veritable factories for jihadis. They emerged out of that very experience. Baghdadi. All right, Baghdadi is another one. Yeah. And if this is not a solution, right? This is like taking aspirin for AIDS. It's not going to work. And it's going to produce the opposite effect. And I really do worry about that. I really worry about that. All right? Because when these young guys get going, it's going to be a long night. No. It's going to be a long night.
Self-perpetuating.
Especially the Egyptians. I'll say this as just a personal anecdote. I mean, I lived in Egypt for a number of years. I got to know the Egyptians. I love Egypt. I love Cairo. I was in Tahrir Square the night of the runoff between Morsi and Shafiq. You remember that? And I was right down there in Tahrir Square, and they were handing out little leaflets saying, "Ala juthati," over my dead body. And I'm telling you, I mean, Egyptians I had known for years, all of a sudden I didn't know them. There was a different energy, and they meant it. It scared me to death. This stuff is real. It has real explosive capabilities, right? And I just hope that, you know, we learn some lessons and that this kind of discourse gets an opportunity to speak and be heard by people who could really make a difference. Thank you.